Hey y'all, this is Sam, and this is Crimology. This is episode 145. Again, this week I am without Steven. He is on a work trip, so we weren't able to get together this week. But this was a week that I was going to try to get together with him because it's one of his kind of favorite cases. It's a heist, and it's the first heist that we've had in a very long time, and I know he likes these type of cases, so I was excited to get with him, but again, schedules, we just weren't able to do that, so we'll have to do it without him and then just gloat later. But before we get started, make sure to do all of the things. We have Instagram and Facebook. Both are at Crimology Pod. Email crimologypod at gmail.com. Send over comments, questions, concerns, all of those good things over there. Make sure you like, subscribe, comment, 5 stars, share, do all of those things. Let's jump into this week's episode. This is episode 145, the Gardner Museum Heist. So this week's state is, I normally have Steven to say this word for me, Massachusetts. I think I said that right. Another case we've already covered for this state is Lizzie Borden. So, March 18th, 1990, two security guards are working the night shift at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. 23-year-old Rick and 25-year-old Randy, and this just so happened to be Randy's first day on the job, but Rick had been working here for a little bit of time. Now, protocol for security guards at the museum was that one man was to sit at the security desk while the other patrolled around the museum. Then that man would come back to the desk, they would switch, and then this was basically the whole night is that kind of same routine. And so they always carried around a walkie-talkie with them and a flashlight around with them to obviously communicate with the walkie-talkie. Now, while Rick was making his round, the fire alarms started going off in several rooms of the museum with no signs of smoke or fire. Now, Rick went to the fire alarm control panel where it said smoke was indicated in several of the rooms that he had already checked. Now, he figured it was a malfunction since he didn't see anything in those rooms, so he disabled the panel. But before finishing his rounds, he checked all of those rooms again, even going to a side entrance of the museum that the employees entered, or that the employees used to enter into the museum. He opened up the door to kind of see if anything was going on out there to cause this, like if there was smoke coming on out from outside or whatever, but didn't see anything. And so this is a good point to use later. So there's a reason why I bring up this door in particular. So he finishes his rounds. He goes back and checks all of those other rooms. Still no sign of smoke, no sign of fire. So doesn't really know what it is. And so it kind of just continues with his rounds. And then he returns to Randy at the desk. The two men switch and then Randy starts his rounds. Now, a little while after Randy left the desk and starts his round, it's about 1:20 a.m., someone pushes the buzzer for a side entrance to the museum, that same side entrance that Rick stuck his head out to kind of look at. There was a buzzer, like, just a few minutes after Rick sticks his head out there to kind of look and see what's going on. There's a buzzer that someone's trying to get into the door. When Rick pulled up the camera to check who it was, he sees two men at the door dressed in police uniforms. The men said that they were responding to a call about a disturbance and they needed to be in to check the area out. Now, Rick immediately thinks that this had something to do with the fire alarms that went off earlier, that maybe that's why they were there. So Rick went against protocol and allowed the two men to enter the building through the employee entrance. So the two men walked through the museum, and they approached Rick at the security desk, while Rick radioed for Randy to come back to the desk. Now, one of the two men said that Rick looked very familiar to him. And he started to say that Rick looked like someone who they had been searching for a very long time for. That they had a warrant for someone's arrest, and they looked just like Rick. So they asked Rick to come out from behind the desk and show them some ID. And Rick follows their instructions. The real reason they were doing this is because they knew that there was a panic button, that this panic button behind the desk was the only panic button in the museum. So they didn't want Rick to get suspicious of anything and push it. So they knew that they needed to get Rick out from behind the desk. So this is the only thing that they're thinking of is like, let's say this thing. You come out from behind the desk. Let's search you. Like, let's get some ID. Let's just kind of put this to rest before we actually look at what's going on. So we need you to come on this side of the desk. And Rick does. He comes out from behind the desk. And when he does, the two men attack him and end up putting him in handcuffs. Soon after this, Randy walks into the room where they do the same to him. While leaving the men in handcuffs, they also wrap the two men's heads and eyes in duct tape. And there are some pictures that I obviously can't put on Instagram and Facebook because then they get taken down for explicit images or whatever. So I don't think I'll be able to post these pictures. But when I say like wrapping around the guy's heads, like I'm trying to just describe it. It's like you started the tape on their forehead and you just wrapped it around their whole head. So like it's going over their hair. It's like it has no rhyme or reason. Sometimes it's on their mouth, but they like did a good job of like not putting it on the nose and the mouth so they could breathe. But it wasn't just like one kind of little loop around the head where the eyes are. Like it was like they used a whole package of duct tape on two men. And they just kept going round and around. Like, it was kind of overkill how much duct tape was on these men. So, to put that into perspective, because again, I don't think I'll be able to post those pictures. After these men wrapped them in duct tape, the two men led the security guards into the basement of the museum, where they then tied them up to poles and pipes and different things, and they leave the security guards there. This is also a big piece of information in this case because it shows that these men knew the museum well because they didn't ask for directions down to the basement. So this was something that it wasn't just we know our way around the museum to get from the security or the employee entrance to the security desk because that's what you would think that would be pretty easy. But it was more than this, being able to find the basement and being able to tie you up. So it was just a little bit of information in this case. The thieves waited about 20 minutes after they tied the two security guards up before actually stealing anything because they wanted to make for sure that the police weren't going to show up. They wanted to make sure that somehow Rick didn't actually push the panic button and they didn't find out. So they waited about 20 minutes. But after this time went by, they go into action. In the span of 81 minutes, the thieves take a total of 13 art pieces. The men take the art out of the frames that were hanging. Some frames were destroyed. The next day, officials even noticed that the men tried to undo some of the frames, but they weren't able to do so. So, like, kind of left it halfway done. So, it was also predicted that, like, a lot of the frames were drilled into the wall. And so, they didn't have tools to undrill it. So, they would try to do it by hand. And it was like they would do it halfway before they were like, no, we don't have time. Like, let's move on to the next one. So, it was also predicted that if those security measures, even something simple as drilling something into the wall, saved a lot of this artwork also. Now, also, the museum had motion detectors, so the men's movements were caught, not by video, but by record. So what I mean is it would say, like, movement in this room at this time, and then movement in that room at this time, and so on and so on. So it gave officials times, and so it said, here's when they entered, here's when they left. So here's like kind of a good rough estimate of how long they were gone. And then it also, I mean, obviously the museum would know if pieces were missing, but it also just let them know if there was anything left behind. So the worst case scenario is, did they enter this room and leave something in that room that could damage other people the next day when they come back into the museum? So this also is what helped them kind of track them while they were in the museum. Before leaving, the thieves went into the security director's office and they took video cassettes of them entering the building and the printouts of these movements from the motion detectors. But what they weren't aware of is that all of this information automatically saved to a hard drive. This was 1990, so like this was some of the like technology. It was very advanced at this point. It's funny to us to be like, yeah, well, duh. But at this time, like that probably wasn't common knowledge to have things like this just automatically back up to a drive. And so they're taking the video cassette of them entering. They're taking all of this stuff thinking, okay, we're scotch free. Like we're out of here. We're good. All of the, what's the word I'm looking for? Evidence that we have is with us. So we're good. The thieves then left the museum at 2:25 a.m. with 13 pieces of art. Now at 8 a.m., the next security guard shows up for his shift, and he immediately knows that something is wrong when a man isn't at the security desk to follow protocol. And then when he radios for Rick or Randy and doesn't get a reply, he calls 911. And then at 8:15 a.m., Rick and Randy are found still tied up in the basement. So the two thieves had been gone for a significant amount of time before it was even realized that any of these art was missing. Now, this is known as the single largest property theft in the world. The stolen pieces are valued at hundreds of millions of dollars. Experts started to question why the thieves took the specific pieces they did when in the same room that they stole from, there was more valuable pieces. Now, some of the pieces they did take were like one in only 30 of the world. So they did take some valuable pieces, but it was kind of just one of those where experts are like, well, why'd you take that one when the one right next to it is 10 times as rare or 10 times as expensive? So this also gives experts a little bit more of information of maybe they didn't really actually know a lot about art, and maybe it really wasn't something that was premeditated in the sense of we're going in and we're stealing this one because it's high in market, or this one. And it was basically like, let's get our whatever we can get our hands on. So this is just all trying to look at, I'm big into Criminal Minds now. So I keep saying in my head, like this keeps going to the profile of the people that we're looking for. And that's genuinely what's going on. However, this is still an active and ongoing investigation as of today. And to this day, no arrests have ever been made related to this case. The museum is still offering a $10 million reward for information leading to the recovery of the stolen pieces. They're even offering $100,000 for one piece specifically. Now, there have been a lot of suspects related to this case. So we're not going to go, normally in a case like this that is ongoing or has never been solved, I'll go over different suspects or different theories and stuff. However, there's a lot of suspects. This is in Boston, so it's a very gang mafia related town, and specifically at this time. So there's a lot of different gang members, mafia members that are thought to have done this, or just a lot of different thieves or different prisoners at the time who were so in and out of prison and kind of doing this same thing. So there are just so many suspects that were listed in this case that we're not going to go one by one. But kind of the big one that I looked at and I was like, that's kind of a good lookout. Like that's a kind of a good option for me was the Boston Mafia. Now, the Mafia was looked at more in 1994. However, the Mafia and a gang in the Boston area, they had both denied any involvement in the theft. They did give officials and police information or other leads, but really those leads led to nothing. So not only have they denied any involvement, but they're not really giving any leads that help officials to begin with. But in 1994, the museum received an anonymous letter attempting to negotiate the return of the art. The writer said that they were a third-party negotiator and said that they had no idea who the actual thieves were, but that they do know that the art was stolen to reduce a prison sentence until the moment passed. Now, this lined up with what officers thought at the time of the theft, because at this time, the Boston Mafia's like captain was in prison. And they immediately thought that this might have been the exact reason they stole the art to begin with. So, like, at the beginning of this case, officials are thinking, this got to be the Boston Mafia, and they're going to hold this, and then they're, you know, so this literally exact situation, they're like, it's the Boston Mafia because this guy's in prison, they're going to try to do this. And then they get this letter. But, however, the captain of the Mafia was murdered in prison a year later after the theft happened, so they never got their opportunity to negotiate. So in the letter, they negotiated immunity for themselves as the writer and for everyone involved, along with $2.6 million, all for the return of the artwork. Now the writer ends the letter by saying, if they had a deal and the museum agreed, they needed to place a coded message in the Boston Globe. And then when they had this done, they would then receive another letter kind of detailing the exchange. Like, here's what's going to happen next, blah, blah, blah. So the museum agrees. The museum brings this to the FBI. They're saying, listen, this is the best lead that we've gotten in the year since this crime. We think this is a for real thing. We need to act on this. The FBI agrees. So they put this coded message in the Boston Globe. And now they're just waiting for a reply back from these people. So after they posted the coded message, they get the second letter. But it said how the writer was getting cold feet. The writer was worried that the FBI wouldn't keep their side of the deal, that they would actually get jail time, that nobody was actually going to be saved, that they weren't going to get any of the money. They were just getting cold feet, and they were like, I don't really know if I trust you. So they said that they had to think about everything, that they really had to sit down, they had to think things through, and that they would get back to the museum when they had made their final decision. But the museum never received another letter. In March 2013... the FBI said that they had made significant progress in their investigation. They felt confident that the art pieces were flown to Connecticut and Philadelphia after the theft, but after this, they weren't sure where they were sent from there. So at least this kind of narrows it down from they literally could have sent it everywhere in the world to, okay, it's still in the U.S., which is just a little bit more of information. And then in 2015, the FBI said that they were confident that they knew who their two thieves were, that they were both involved in the Boston Mafia, but at this point, they were both dead. No other information has come about with this case since then. The FBI never said, here's the name of the two thieves that we think it is. Names have never been posted. Names have never been brought forward. And since this information in 2015, there has been no new information. So whatever has happened to the paintings, we may never find out what happened. To this day, the museum Like I said, some of the frames were destroyed, so those frames were replaced. But a big thing that the museum has done is they've kept those frames, those empty frames where these art were stolen. They've kept these empty frames up in the museum, and it ends up still, I mean, this case and this story brings a lot of people still into this museum, but they leave these frames open because for the people of the museum, it shows a little bit of hope that they are hopeful that one day these pieces of art will come back to the museum, and that they will make their way back home. But as of it is today, no new information has come forward. There's been events in the story, like when you even Google this, the title of this, there's a lot of different articles that come forward about various mafia members that FBI or air officials were working closely with, and they were thinking that they were gonna get information from them, and then they just passed away just of old age, because also this happened in the 1990s, and it was suspected that the men who committed these crimes were in their 30s. So at this time, they would just naturally start passing away because of age. So you'll see a lot of articles that are just saying that a lot of these people have started passing away because of age. Rick, who was one of the security guards of this night and who let the thieves into the museum, he also passed away recently. And so we're getting a lot of articles like that where it's this person who played a significant part in this case has passed. But as far as information, there's not a lot still that we have there. And so I think this is also one of those where, I mean, I think it's also crazy to think about that you commit this crime in 1990 and you stole 13 pieces of artwork. In the letter, they stated that all of the artwork was kept in pristine conditions, that they were stored how they were supposed to be stored. So it wasn't like they were just rolling them up and throwing in, you know, a tote bag or something off to the side. They were actually keeping, taking care of them. So it's also just wild to be like, too wild to think about, like, where are they now? Are they all together, or are there 13 families out there who have one of these pieces of artwork and have dedicated their lives to keeping this secret? You know, it's just, anyways, it's kind of crazy to think about. Or are they all stuck in a box somewhere in an air-conditioned storage room that we may never see? I don't know. It's crazy. But who knows? We may be getting information. Who knows? Sometime we find out what happened to them, but I just know this is one of those cases that Steven would like, so I'm disappointed that I'm not be able to see him or be with him, but this is one of those other cases where it makes you think about, like, oh, did this happen? Did that happen? Did this happen? So I guess I also like cases like this where it's unsolved, and so you get to kind of think about what happened. So anyways, I'll stop. Episode 145. Next week, our state is Utah, so make sure to come for that. Yeah, Instagram, Facebook, email, 5 stars, share, like, subscribe, do all of those things. Thank you guys so much for listening. Hopefully next week I'm with Steven. But until then, like always, this is Sam, and this is Crimeology.